I think in part because it's the now the seventh week of the introductory course, I thought today I would talk a little bit about compassion. There's a way, Buddhism, there's two wings to Buddhist practice, two supports for Buddhist practice. And these two wings are usually called compassion and wisdom. And the insight meditation practice of Vipassana mindfulness that we teach here, in a very kind of simplistic way, belongs to the side of wisdom. It's a wisdom practice. It's a practice that leads to wisdom. It leads to liberation. But in order for the practice to be balanced, there needs to be an element of compassion as part of it. And for me, this is very important because the insight practice by itself, without compassion, can be appear sometimes to be kind of dry and can lend itself to various kinds of misunderstandings about how we can get engaged with life. One way is that sometimes we confuse mindfulness with self-consciousness, being self-conscious. Many of us are self-conscious. Self-critical. And what we learn through insights, the things we learn about ourselves or the world, the increased understanding we have, the increased insight, can feed right into the habit of being self-conscious or being self-critical. The more we learn about ourselves, the more fuel you have to be better self-conscious, better self-critical. It's great, isn't it? Do it really well. And that's not the spirit of mindfulness, is not to give us more fuel to be self-conscious or be self-critical, but rather to help us become free of those very tendencies. And there's a huge difference between getting angry and feeling the anger arise in your sitting, for example, or in daily life, and then saying, "Oh shit, I'm angry, I blew it," versus seeing the anger arise and just simply noting to yourself, "Oh, there's anger here. Anger is arising." The first, it belongs to maybe the world of self-consciousness or self-criticalness, and the second one is just the open, accepting awareness of awareness, accepting presence of awareness, just allowing it to be there. When I first started doing Buddhist practice many years ago, the insight part, the wisdom part, was particularly what attracted me to Buddhism, is why I was interested in it. And I wasn't interested in compassion, and there was no real place for compassion for in my, even in my vocabulary. I knew what the word meant, but I didn't use it, I didn't think about it. And so I wasn't drawn to the compassion sides of Buddhism. I was just interested in the pure sword of wisdom that cut through all the delusions. And I remember when I was, my first year being kind of early year, when I was a Buddhist practitioner, I had a very nice girlfriend. And however, she was not a practitioner. And at that early year, when I was kind of really devoting myself to a lot of Buddhist practice, I became very sensitive to through the insight practice to how myself and many people around me operated on certain kind of ego trips. And you know, I had my favorite ego trip that I was on, and other people had theirs, and we all kind of supported each other in our ego trips. You know, it was great. I noticed that because when I stopped, because I found it a little bit difficult my early years to maintain some of the friendships that I had, because some of the friendships I had before I started doing a lot of meditation were used to me being a certain way. And my usual way of being was a self that was built on fear and assuming a certain kind of identity, a certain kind of persona, and acting it out and being one of the chums or whatever. And as I started sitting and doing a meditation practice, some of the fear-based, fear-inspired personalities that I had kind of assumed and was acting through no longer operated, at least when I was meditating. And then I started wanting to kind of live with that kind of integrity or authenticity in my daily life also. And what happened was that some of my friends couldn't get used to this kind of new gill. It just didn't work so well. And it was, I felt kind of awkward there. And one of the reasons I went to live at the Buddhist Meditation Center was to be around other people who are kind of doing the same thing, trying to do the same thing, so I can get support in finding this new way of being in the world, somehow expressing or living the integrity I felt in meditation. Anyway, so I was living as part of a Buddhist community, and I had this girlfriend who was not living there and not a practitioner. And I was very sensitive to my ego trips and other people's ego trips, and I had no patience for them. And so she had her share, like every normal person has. And I saw them there. I wasn't critical of them particularly, but I wasn't going to buy into them or share in them or get involved with them. She talked way back then about getting strokes. You needed a lot of strokes. And I wasn't into giving people strokes. I thought that was kind of a, you know, an ego trip of itself. And so, as you can imagine, it was that romance had a sad ending. And some years later, I realized that in fact I did have some insight, some understanding going in the time of that relationship and about her and things. But what I lacked was compassion. I didn't have any sense of who she was as a kind of deeper person, as a person who was suffering and struggling and doing the best she could to manage with life and needed support and trying to manage best with life. And maybe it was a little bit maladaptive the way she had it, but you know, she was basically a fine person. And I just didn't have the sensitivity to who she was as a full human being. And so I needed a lot of compassion. That's what I needed to develop. And I did with time. And when I finally kind of started developing it, so then I could look back and realize what I'd done in that relationship. And the same thing with us ourselves, you know, kind of the relationship we have to ourselves. Many of us don't realize how harsh we are, how hard we are to ourselves. And one of the things we need to do is to try the best we can to bring some compassion to ourselves as we do this practice. Not to be hard on ourselves. If we are hard on ourselves, to hold that hardness, to hold that pain of self-criticalness or shame or embarrassment or whatever, to hold it with some compassion, with some care, with some forgiveness. In those early years of my Zen practice, as I said, I didn't realize that compassion was really part of Buddhism. I was not interested in it. And I look back now at my early years of practice, I noticed that I thought I was cultivating wisdom, the wisdom side of Buddhism. And really what was happening for me was I was being, I was developing compassion unconsciously, because that's really what I needed. And as I sat with my mindfulness and my presence to my life, those early years, I sat with a lot of inner turmoil and suffering. And it was very difficult for me, some of my early years of practice. It was very difficult to encounter myself and face myself and see the degree to which I was self-critical, the degree to which I felt guilty all the time. The degree to which I was afraid a lot of the time, and I was just and seeing all that and just feeling my own suffering in it, that itself was how compassion was born. To feel, to be in the proximity of suffering and to open to it and be willing to experience the pain there, that itself, the heart begins to soften or to quiver or to feel the compassion. And so really what was happening in my early years of practice, the primary thing and the important thing for me was slowly my heart was opening, and I was starting to feel much more compassion and care for myself and the world around me. And that was significant looking back now, because I think a lot of us, especially people new to practice, are trying to measure their progress in a meditation practice. They're measuring their spiritual progress, how well they're doing, and they measure themselves against all kinds of standards they have of what's perfect practice is or someone else. And I think sometimes we don't really know what's happening within us, what's moving, what's developing, what's really significant in our practice in the middle of it. I've known many people who've gone on long retreats, 10-day retreats or longer, and at the end of the retreat they might say, oh, it was really significant that I saw the possibility of being really at peace, or really trusting life, or I saw... You know, I was able to get really calm. I'd never been calm in my life or peaceful in my life. Or I understood something about my way my personality works, with my childhood, and it released me from this, and that was really significant. And they might say some all kinds of things at the end of a retreat. And then if you ask them 6 months later, what was significant about that retreat, they have a whole different evaluation of it. Some of the things that were so significant at the time have faded from memory, faded from significance. The calm they had, you know, has faded away. But what's significant is the fact that maybe their heart began to soften. They were able to be with themselves in a softer, kinder way. And that kindness then was what carried over through the months and the years. And really kindness was what was significant, not insight, not calm or whatever. So in my case, it was a compassion. Was a development of compassion. I think, you know, that it's extremely hard to be a human being. And not only is it hard in general, but I think it's phenomenally hard in this part of California. Maybe it's, you know, I don't know, maybe I'm being myopic because this is where I live. But I'm just astounded by the pressures that people are under, a lot of people in this community in Silicon Valley, and the amount of pressure they are to work a lot and just get by, and the cost of rent or home so high. And I think people suffer a lot. And then there's a kind of a disease of affluence that kind of surrounds us, and people acquire a lot of things, and there's kind of peer pressure, you know. They're kind of almost by osmosis, almost not even wanting it. We kind of begin assuming the values of the people around us, which are have a lot to do with consumer values and attaining and being successful. Somewhere today, recently I read, have you ever seen a employment advertisement, you know, wanted, a sales representative who is kind, compassionate, and gentle? office manager. Requirements: compassionate, gentle, spacious. I think more likely you find kind of opposite qualities that are valued, being ambitious or efficient or hard or whatever. I don't know what, but I think it's very hard. People here suffer a lot. And I think there's a notion among many people of that if you suffer or if you struggle, something is wrong with you, that there's a problem with you. We hold ourselves up against some kind of standard or scale of perfection or being success or being whatever that is not who we really are. And all too often, when this is the case, when we have some idea of perfection or how we should be against how we really are, that there's a strong tendency to begin to turn our attention away from that part of our... Either turn our attention away from that part of us which doesn't fit the standard and so become numb to it, or focus on it even more, but in a critical way, in a biting way. And as the mindfulness kind of unfolds, what naturally will happen is we open up to the full range of who we are, and the disowned parts begin to show themselves. And if the disowned parts are disowned because they're unacceptable, then it can be very painful to meet them. And so we need compassion. We need to kind of, I think it's very, very important to receive ourselves with a kind of accepting awareness where we can feel the suffering we have and be willing to kind of be there in a gentle way and caring way for ourselves. Not to be so hard on ourselves, not to see ourselves always through the lens of shoulds, but to actually be with us as we are, with all our difficulties, all our struggles, and all our imperfections. There was some years ago I saw a book that had a beautiful title. It was called The Spirituality of Imperfection. I thought it was a great title. And maybe that's what we're doing here, is really spirituality of imperfection. We're not trying to attain some wonderful, glorious state of perfection, but rather some wonderful, glorious state of accepting our imperfection. The Zen master Dogen said, deluded people are deluded about enlightenment. Enlightened people are enlightened about delusion. And I think it's lovely, because sometimes we're kind of focusing on the great light of enlightenment, or great perfection, or great something. And we think it is, we have all these ideas about what it is, and we focus on it, and we're confused about it. But actually, enlightened people are completely uninterested in enlightenment. But what it is to be enlightened is to really understand our imperfection, really to understand what it's like to be deluded, to really understand what it's like to be a human being, not to try not being a human being, but rather to be a human being with compassion and acceptance for who we are. So compassion is one of the ideals of Buddhism, but compassion is not born idealistically. You can't will compassion. You can't read a book about Buddhism and say, oh, Buddhism is one of the great ideals. You're supposed to have compassion. So, okay, you steel yourself and brace yourself and kind of hold yourself with compassion. It doesn't work that way. You can't will compassion in the abstract. Compassion is only born in the contact with suffering and pain. And so what it means is that to the degree in which compassion is an important virtue to be developed, there has to be the willingness to experience that part of life, part of our life, which is also painful. Not to turn away from it, not to glance away, not to ignore it. Not necessarily to search it out, but not to turn away from it when it appears. A kind of a willingness to be tender to ourselves for what is difficult about our life and difficult about ourselves. And I think this, again, I keep saying this, but I think it's extremely important for those of you who are doing mindfulness practice, because as you become more mindful of yourself, you will naturally become aware of the parts of yourself which are difficult. It's inevitable that way. And so then will you meet that? How do you meet that? How do you meet the difficult parts of yourself, the parts of yourself you don't want to look at, the parts of yourself which is unacceptable? One of the exercises, maybe we can do it here briefly. To the degree, to the contact you've had now with Buddhist practice or with a mindfulness practice, what do you sense are some of the ideals that you might be living under now that you've encountered this practice? What are some of the ideas you might have about how you're supposed to be, or what you're supposed to attain, or what's supposed to happen to you as you do this practice? So please, what have you picked up? Being more mindful, okay. Non-judging. What else?
Being more vulnerable.
Being more vulnerable, good.
Accepting.
Being accepting.
Becoming open to both positives and negatives.
Becoming open to positive and negative.
Being non-reactive.
Being non-reactive.
Being present.
Being present.
Non-attachment.
Non-attachment.
More honest.
The nice thing was just go spend the evening doing this. So then I ask you, given that those are kind of ideals or kind of, can you imagine that that you might see some things as being unacceptable in the light of those ideals? What might you see as unacceptable?
Murder.
Murder? I hope there's other reasons to see murder as being unacceptable.
Unconsciousness. Expressing anger. Lying.
White lies.
Exploiting people.
How about inside yourself? How you are? Not so much actions.
Nothing.
Nothing. Nothing? Meaning everything's acceptable for you? Mm-hmm. What did you say before for the ideal parts? You said something, I forget. Non-reactive. So is it okay with you to be reactive?
It's okay. Forgiving and loving.
Forgiving and loving. So what?
Toward yourself.
That's the ideal. So what's unacceptable then?
Being too judgmental, obviously.
Being too judgmental. So what I'm trying to get at is that I think that many people internalize ideals or standards, and there are beautiful ones that you talked about earlier, and definitely they're part of the practice. But it can be very subtle, or sometimes very gross, that as soon as we adopt a standard of being non-judgmental, then the judgmental parts of ourselves doesn't fit that, and so that's disowned or pushed away, or we're ashamed of it. The classic one in Buddhist circles is anger. Someone said before that, you know, someone mentioned anger, being angry. Buddhist cultures in general, and this is a generalization, tend to be cultures that are emphasize loving kindness, compassion, as opposed to being angry. And when you emphasize those parts of kindness and compassion, then which is a beautiful thing to emphasize, but then anger is kind of disvalued. You know, when you go to Buddhist culture, you're not supposed to express your anger so much. And so the anger part of many Buddhists then resides in a kind of submerged place, kind of hidden place, and it kind of festers there for people. That's why I say that Buddhist culture needs to have Buddhist practice. Because if you have Buddhist culture without practice, then you have this kind of bias towards certain kind of values against other kind of values. And the function of practice is to somehow help us go beyond the biases. Somehow not to keep anything in the unacceptable realm. Not to say, this part of me is unacceptable, I can't look at that. You know, we feel like we want to murder someone. Don't do it. But say we want to murder someone. I've known people who felt tremendous conflict and shame and fear about themselves because desire for to really harm someone else arose. But I think that it's relatively normal to periodically to feel strong feelings and ideas and fantasies like that. And to shut it down and saying it's unacceptable is actually to, in some ways, give it potentially much more juice where it can fester and come out in unhealthy ways. But to accept ourselves for the whole range of who we are allows for us not to kind of create kind of unhealthy amount of charge around any part of ourselves. So even the anger part, can we accept ourselves for being angry? Can we receive that in a compassionate, feel the suffering of that? Accept it and feel the suffering as part of it and allow it to be. Even if for the sake of other people, opening to our own suffering is very important. Because as we become more familiar with our suffering and be honest about it, then it's possible to resonate and feel more the suffering of the people around us. And part of the function of Buddhist practice is to allow us, help us to meet other people as equals and not to hold ourselves removed from others, either by being so kind of looking down at them, at their suffering and kind of pitying them, or ignoring them entirely, kind of numbing out and walking away. But to be able to know that we suffer and know something about our suffering, then I think we kind of, that resonates with the suffering of other people, and we can meet them as equals much more. And that's compassion, to meet people as equals. To meet with pity, in the Buddhist definition of pity, is to kind of be kind of aloof and look down on someone, is condescending, is actually is not compassion. So as I, in my Buddhist practice, as I opened up to my suffering and was willing to receive it and hold it there with gentleness and care and compassion and allowing it to be there, not denying it anymore like I had when I was younger, the miracle that happened was I became much more sensitive to the suffering of people around me. And then I became much more motivated and interested to try to be of service and be of help and to meet other people in their suffering. This is maybe an aside, not directly connected, but as I did my practice, I became softer and softer and more sensitive. But when I left the Zen monastery after 3 years, I came back to San Francisco, and that was back when the movie Gandhi had just come out. And so I went and saw it, and I cried during parts of the movie. And the thought that, and so I was, when I was leaving the theater, the thought that went through my mind was, what's wrong with me? Crying? I never used to cry at movies. You know, 3 years of Zen training and I'm a failure, spiritual failure. Here I'm crying at a movie. And so the next thought that occurred to me was, no, 3 years of Zen practice wasn't a failure, it was a success. The fact that now I could cry at a movie. I thought that was a good sign, because I never used to. My heart became softer and more tender. The tenderizing of the heart is a definition of our practice. Isn't that nice? I think it's nice. I hope you think it's nice. But to allow ourselves to be who we are and to meet that. And I think it's an important point to make, because I guess I'm making it too many times this evening. But as we sit open to ourselves and are mindful, it's inevitable we're going to meet parts of ourselves that are painful, that are hurt, that suffer. And it's inevitable we meet parts of ourselves that we don't want to look at. And then the question is, how do you relate to that? And one of the ways we try to do is to relate to it with compassion. And if we can't relate to it with compassion, with care, with gentleness, then at least try to relate to it with a willingness to feel it, a willingness to allow it to be there. And then you'll find the miracle of compassion will be born in you, kind of almost naturally, almost against your will. So wisdom and compassion, two sides of the practice. Yes?
So I have a question. When your heart opens, did your dark side, when you experienced your darker side, anger, were you more able to express that in a kind of compassionate way?
Well, sure. I think what happened was that as I opened to my dark side, the painful sides of me, that brought about compassion. And as I was more compassionately accepting of it, then I could feel it and see it honestly, and then try. That wasn't always successful, but there was much more opportunities then to, if I needed to act skillfully, knowing that was part of it. Does that make sense? So, for example, if I was angry with someone, I was much more. My early years of practice, I was unwilling to see that I ever had anger. So. If you're unwilling to see that, then you don't have it. At least you don't think so, right? And so as I started opening up and being aware of it more for myself, then I could see it coming. I could see it arise. And then I would try to respond to the situation skillfully. Sometimes that meant I would walk away from the situation for 10 minutes until my anger subsided, and then come back and deal with it if that was an option, because I learned that if I dealt with it while I was angry, I'd make mistakes. Or sometimes I would, if I didn't have that option, sometimes I would speak in a way that wasn't offensive. I remember once when I was got angry with the chairman of my department when I was in Hawaii, in the religious studies department in Hawaii. I got angry at the chairman of the department because I think he did something painful, hurtful for me. I was his TA. He made things really, my life really difficult for me. He told me that they assigned me to be a TA for two professors that semester. And he said, "Oh, you'll manage fine. You can just find your own way between the two and just share the load evenly between the two of them." Well, yeah. So basically, I had twice as much work. So I got really angry with him. And I didn't have the option of walking away. So I went to talk to him. And I was so angry, I was actually kind of shaking. But I knew I was angry, and I knew I had enough sense to kind of accept it and not try to, repress it for myself. So I went to him, and kind of shaking, I said, "When you did that, my response now is I feel really angry right now." I said it in such a way that I wasn't blaming him or I wasn't attacking him. And he received it in that spirit. And he softened, and we had a great conversation. So I learned this by opening to it and being present for it in an accepting way. I began to learn the skill of how to express it in a non-offensive way. And that was very useful for me. As I've continued to understand my anger, for example, I've understood that anger arises usually for me, and I think for most people, out of hurt and out of fear. So as I become more sensitive and more allowing and more willing to open to it all, I begin understanding the roots of it. And so then I can respond not necessarily from the point of the anger, but from the point of my suffering that's under the anger. And that's often a much wiser way of responding. So respond from the root of the issue and not from the symptoms. this answer your question?
Yes.
Yes.
How does meditating, following your breath, allow you to see something like anger that you didn't know you had?
Well, following your breath, if you'd say that's all a person did in meditation, I think there's a tendency that when we follow our breath and are able to get a little bit calm around following the breath, that the normal defenses and the normal identity structures that we create for ourselves, the normal distractions that we use to distract ourselves from ourselves, stop operating so strongly. They quiet down. And as they quiet down, as the surface kind of crust of the mind quiets down, then what's underneath there begins to show itself. And so we start seeing the things we weren't looking at or denying or pushing away. And you might not see it very clearly, because if you're still focusing on the breath, you're not really looking at that. You get kind of a side glance at it, perhaps. But still, I think you become more aware of it. In mindfulness practice, we don't stay only with the breath. What we do is we stay with the breath the best we can, but when strong emotions arise, for example, then we forget about the breath, and we actually bring the light of awareness onto that emotion and face it directly. And but that's why we get to know it really well. Someone else? Yes?
You were talking about acceptance. Acceptance is one of the primary things. And sometimes I feel like in striving for acceptance, that then I think maybe I can't be an active agent. Like I can't say no to things, or I can't.
Oh.
Like for instance, you know, obviously took action and went to talk to the person instead of just accepting the situation.
Right.
Do you have any, I don't know, words of, like, balance in that?
Well, this is, I don't know if I can convey this so well, but I'll try. And that is, the acceptance that we talk about in this kind of practice is not necessarily accepting the situation as it is. It's receiving the situation in awareness, where awareness doesn't react to the situation. Awareness doesn't contract or resist. But there's a place inside of us, a kind of sense of presence or sense of awareness or kind of knowing that can be open and receive all kinds of difficulties with the same spacious acceptance of a sunset. Awareness itself, the mind itself doesn't contract. The mind itself doesn't resist. But for the mind or the awareness or the knowing not to resist, not to contract, doesn't mean that other parts of us, our common sense, for example, doesn't come into play. It means that then we can act through our common sense, but the mind hasn't contracted. So that's why the meditation practice is so powerful, because in meditation, nothing needs to be decided. It's pretty rare, occasionally, but pretty much you don't have to decide anything. You don't have to decide, you know, if you're going to pay your bills or not, or what you're going to have for dinner, or you know, what to do about the person at work or whatever. So in meditation, you don't have to decide anything. So you have the opportunity in meditation to discover the zero point of non-reactivity and really get familiar with it. This place where the mind doesn't contract or resist or hold on or cling. And then you learn what that is in the mind. And then you can then hopefully begin in daily life to have an accepting awareness, but not necessarily an accepting discernment. I don't know if that's the right expression. So there's a difference between accepting something in awareness and accepting something in our discernment about what needs to be done. Does this make sense, the difference? Maybe the difference is accepting it in our heart versus accepting it in I don't know if discernment is the right word, but in our common sense. So when we say acceptance, we certainly don't mean condoning it. It certainly doesn't mean leaving the external situation or as it is necessarily. But so, for example, if someone at work yells at you, can you accept that? It doesn't mean that you kind of just walk away or say, "Well, that's fine. It's great what you're doing. I like that you're yelling at me." It means that your mind or your heart doesn't close. It stays open. And having stayed open, maybe you feel the suffering of someone yelling at you. And then you can kind of say, hey, wait a minute, what's going on here? This is not appropriate. This is not appropriate behavior. I'm not going to stand for this. But you're actually, if you discover that zero point in us that doesn't have to react to situations, then it gives you actually tremendous power. Because you're much more likely to be fearless. Because then you tend to act then with less concern about how you're going to be hurt based on your actions. Does that make sense, all this? When I started the teacher training program for this teaching this kind of Buddhism with Jack Kornfield, there were just 5-6 of us sitting in a circle. And Jack Kornfield asked each of us, now that you're going to embark on being a Buddhist teacher, what do you have to teach? And so we had to kind of say very succinctly what we... By the time we'd gone around the room, all but one of the people in the room said some version of acceptance, self-acceptance, acceptance as being kind of one of the important points of what they're trying to teach, people teach people acceptance. But one of the women who was there said empowerment. And that kind of jolted me. I said, what does empowerment have to do with this practice? And I went home and told my to-be wife. And then this woman, she said empowerment. And she said, yeah, of course she said that. She was a woman. And then I thought that, then I realized that empowerment and acceptance are two sides of the same coin. And some people emphasize the acceptance part. But the more accepting we are in the way I'm talking about, the actual more empowered you are to act, the more empowered you are actually to change things which you find unacceptable at the discernment level. But then you act. You act to change the situation if that's what's called upon, without the mind hopefully clinging or expecting or being attached to the outcomes or being afraid of what might happen. The mind still can maybe, the potential is for the mind still to stay open or the heart to still stay open as we act. So, is that clarifying about this thing, acceptance? Discovering a zero point. Yes?
I've noticed that with the practice, you become aware of the ego trip that you're on,
yeah,
that other people are on. And then how do you differentiate between compassion for the people, for the situation, and not somehow suddenly turning into pity or condensation?
Mm-hmm. Huh?
And how to walk that fine line and bring it back towards compassion.
Well, I think knowing what it feels like inside of you, the difference. Compassion is actually opening and soft, whereas pity or condemnation or condensation is that the right word? If you pay attention to yourself, what's going on inside of you, you'll feel the suffering inside of you of those things. You'll find yourself contracting, getting narrow focused, tight in different ways. So I often use my body, what's going on in my body, as a guide for understanding how I'm responding and when I'm responding in unhealthy ways and when I'm responding in healthy ways. If you're very sensitive, sometimes you can pick it up through how people respond in return. Because if you respond with people with compassion, you get a different response than if you respond with pity. So you have to be sensitive. So it means paying attention to how you're being received. But I think having some sense of the zero point, some sense, maybe through meditation, of being more spacious and accepting of things, you kind of carry that with you a little bit as a perfume, as a sixth sense. And so you find yourself in situations and you notice when that kind of more spacious, allowing kind of presence is not there. And when I notice that my spacious presence is not there, I try as best I can then to kind of pay more careful attention to what's going on. Because if I don't, then I'm more likely to do unskillful things. So I don't know. I don't know if this responds to you. You want to try again? You want to ask the question in a little bit different way, or? Yes.
When you say acceptance of things, are you talking about no matter what the situation is?
Yes. It's possible that awareness itself holds anything and everything without clinging or resistance. It doesn't mean that our discernment, our common sense, then just kind of... Acceptance doesn't mean that we kind of just let the situation itself go unchanged. Acceptance means awareness itself is willing to receive that situation without resistance or clinging or aversion.
I mean, just acknowledging.
Well, that's part of it, yeah. Acknowledging it spaciously, maybe. Respecting its presence. So, for example, trying to think of an example in my life.
Well, what about the example you gave of the anger you felt for this superior of yours?
Yeah.
Maybe you can use that.
In that situation, what I was accepting of was my confusion and my of my anger itself. That I'm an angry person right now, and I'm confused about what to do. So I was that's what was the main thing that was going on. So I held that in awareness. I could see that, and I tried to be as gently compassionate for that part of me as I could, not demanding that I be different, for example. And then, because the situation required me to do something, I then took that information, my self-understanding, and tried to figure out what the wisest thing to do, given where I was at. And probably it would have been wiser to have walked away and cooled down for a while and then come back later. But in that situation, I didn't have that option. So I accepted myself for what I was, accepted my limitations for who I was, and then I dealt with it best I could. So...
What about in longer term? When you see something that you don't like, you know, you recognize something about yourself that you don't like, you accept it, but then what do you do with it?
Yeah. Now, I think I'm having a hard time conveying what I mean by the word acceptance here. Maybe someone else wants to try explain what I'm trying to say. Someone can put it in different words, the distinction I'm trying to make.
No, I think I understand what you mean there, but what do you, you know, when you recognize traits in yourself, like when as the dust settles in your mind and you see something and you sort of say, oh, I'm not sure I like that part.
My tendency then would be to turn the mirror of mindfulness around and look at that judgment. Mm-hmm. If I'm saying, ooh, I don't like that part, that has a kind of spin on it. That I would be sensitive to, maybe this is maybe something I need to look at my judgment on it, because there's something, some part of me which is kind of turning away from that, or you know, turning my nose up on it or something. So I would then, oh, what's the judgment? What's going on there for me? Oh, I'm holding myself against a certain standard. I have some ideal, or I've internalized my mother's voice, my mother's idea of what a good son is supposed to be like, and you know, you're not supposed to be angry. So when I see anger, I kind of go. So I would look at that. I would turn it around and look at that. If the spin was the way you described it, it could be. You can see a trait differently. You can see, for example, a tendency to be angry, and just see it for what it is. Feel it, accept it, hold it in meditation, allow it to be there. See it for a long time, and then wait a minute. You know, this is not. I have this anger. It's painful for me. And not only that, but I have a tendency sometimes acting out of it, and it seems to cause harm around me to other people. maybe I should look into this. Maybe I should do something. Maybe I should, you know, maybe there's something that various things I can do. Maybe I can do some loving kindness practice as an antidote. Maybe I can do some more penetrating mindfulness practice to really get to the root of it, to understand this, the source of it. Maybe I should go talk to a good friend about my anger and hear what my friend's perception of me is, and maybe they have something interesting to say. Or maybe I should do some therapy, or, you know, or maybe I should go and pound pillows, or, you know, there's many, many things a person might decide to do. And it's fine to want to improve yourself, to pull the weeds from the mind, but we want to look at the intention. And it, the practice of acceptance is to allow ourselves to be who we are, regardless of who we are, the spirituality of imperfection. Can we allow ourselves to be who we are first, and then, out of wisdom, decide how to maybe change yourself, if that's an option? Now, it's not always so easy to change ourselves. So it's pretty good if you can do the acceptance first, because then things won't get so difficult. But I saw Marty's hand, and I always like what Marty has to say. So the person was absolutely furious, red in the face, angry at me. And so I sat there. I basically sat in this position. We had this meeting and to talk about it. And the person spent an hour yelling at me in anger. And after a while, after about half an hour, I got very curious. How long can this person talk without me saying anything? And the person just yelled and told me, you know, all kinds of things about myself, you know, and just fury. And I was able to be very accepting of it, which in this case meant I was able to allow for it. I didn't cringe. It didn't meet any part of me. It wasn't like I was resisting it or defending myself against it or trying to deflect it back. Or I wasn't doing anything with it. The awareness was so open and spacious, I just allowed it to happen. It's like awareness was just like a clean channel. It just passed right through. And so that's the acceptance in the mind or in the heart. And because I could do that, because I can be so spacious around it and so calm around it, I could actually study the situation and myself in the clearest possible way to know what was the wisest thing to do here. This person was suffering a lot. How could I best help this person? How could I do the wisest thing that in the situation? If I had gotten defensive and tried to defend myself or attack the person back, then I wouldn't have the clarity to have known how wisely to respond. And it's important to know how to respond. It's important to respond. It's important to feel empowered to respond. But if you respond from having not accepted it in the mind, to have this resistance in the mind, or the contraction in the mind, or the fear in the mind, then you're not likely to see it so clearly. So eventually I did respond to it. And the next day she came to me and said that it was very helpful for her, because never in her life had she met someone who wasn't afraid of her anger. And the fact that she had met someone else who wasn't afraid of it allowed her to begin owning her anger and looking at it in a way she'd never had before. Mm-hmm. And so in that situation, that was a situation where I decided the wise thing to do was sit there and receive it for such a long time. And it was at a monastery, so at some point the bell rang for some other activity. And in monasteries, when the bell rings, you go to the next activity. What? Yes.
I think of the acceptance as having a component of recognition and appreciation in sort of a conscious and open way, so that you, I mean, it might be a part of yourself that's terribly ugly, but you can go, oh my God, that's ugly. I mean, you recognize it, you can appreciate its ugliness, you're not denying it, you're open to it, and that's, you don't, like you say, necessarily not try to work on it or not try to let it move you to do something, but just
right.
Appreciating and recognizing it is a way towards accepting it.
Now, part of what I'm trying to say here today is that acceptance is not easy. You know, it's a nice thing to say. We're supposed to sit here and accept things, accept ourselves, you know, and the shadow side, the dark side of ourselves, the unacceptable parts. But it's very hard. And it's because of the practice is hard. It's hard to meet ourselves that compassion is so important. That parts of ourselves which are difficult, and we have difficulty with, difficult looking at, difficult accepting, difficult receiving. Because it's difficult in that pain, that suffering, if you can't meet it with acceptance, maybe we can meet it with compassion. When I was ordained as a Zen priest many years ago, the remarkable difference for me, changed in me from before and after that ceremony, was that after the ceremony, I became much more sensitive to my shortcomings. Because now I was kind of a public person, people saw me as a Zen priest, I had a shaved head and all these things. I was much more conscious of my shortcomings. And at the same time, it was more okay to have them. It was very nice, I thought. And it didn't mean I went around being a bully or something. You know, it meant that, you know, that I, then because I was more able to take them into account and try to work with them the best I can. So please, and it's, you know, a strong request. Try to meet yourself with compassion, not with perfection. Last one, then we'll sit.
I've been trying to think about how to talk about this, so excuse me if I don't get it right, but you're talking a lot about how difficult it is to face yourself and the value of meeting yourself with compassion. But one of the experiences I've had, I don't live there all the time, but when I've really seen something about myself that I really didn't like, and I found that I'd been pushing it away a long time and denying it and defensive about it, when I finally saw it and said, oh, and there was a kind of a recognition that I was doing the best that I could do with that my response was not so inappropriate. And I think that's the acceptance thing you're talking about. And it was like a little bubble popped. And I felt compassion.
Mm.
It's not something that I brought to
it.
It was an outcome.
Right.
That was absolutely wonderful. You know, so the whole, I see that relationship as not so much a difficult relationship, but a really wonderful relationship. That when you can really see something and truly feel it, it gives rise to compassion.
Right. And that's kind of a very, very important point, is that we don't bring compassion to our life in the ideal, in the abstract, you know, churning it up in some abstract way. But it's born through the willingness to be with our suffering, be with our difficulty. And so in part, what I'm trying to say today is that you will meet difficult parts, you will meet things that are very hard as you do this practice. You'll meet beautiful, you'll encounter beautiful things also. It isn't just all difficult, but when you encounter difficult things, what is the compassionate response is to be willing to experience it. And as you're willing to experience it, then deep compassion will arise. So which comes first, I don't know. So let's end with a short sitting. It has to be very short. So we'll have to do the sitting very fast. And the good thing about meditation is that it's a kind of cooperative sport, because we all arrive in the present moment at the same time. So close your eyes. And there you've arrived. So what part of yourself would do well to receive some of your compassion? Is there a part of yourself that usually receives criticism or embarrassment, or some part of yourself that can be met with compassion? A couple of announcements.